Today on Rockin' the Suburbs,
we're going up the country to interview Andy Zaks.
Yeah, if you consider downtown Washington, D.C. to be the country.
All right, it's day three of our Woodstock podcast. We've been up all night. We had to record at 2 a.m.,
yeah.
Right? Because we kept getting pushed back and pushed back. And
that's right. Happened. There was weather that came in, right. And the rotating stage didn't work. So we had to improvise.
We're really tired right now for day three of Peace and Music and Andy Zaks.
But we're ready to honor peace, love, and rock and roll.
That's right. So here we go. It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And this is part three of our interview with Andy Zaks. He's the record producer who put together the comprehensive 50th anniversary edition box set. All the music from Woodstock, 38 discs, 36 hours of music, all the bands, including the big ones you know, and maybe some you don't know as well. And he talks a little bit about that
in
today's episode, this segment.
Man, if you study the lineup, there were some weird people that played that show.
Yeah. It's not all just, you know, The Who and Santana and Hendrix, right?
No. There was some strange stuff that happened.
Yeah. So it's all documented now in the proper way. Hats off to Andy for that.
At least, yeah. He still looks great and fairly sane. He did say he was going to go up in the mountains and spend some time detoxing or decompressing. So he sounds like that's well earned.
Yeah. All right. So let's get right to this interview. It's Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And here is Andy Zaks. What were the moments you had where you were like, oh my God, I can't believe nobody's heard this before and I can't wait to get this out?
Sure. Well, there's tons of those.
Yeah.
I mean, both musically and in terms of some of the announcements.
Yeah,
which
the announcements are great.
You know, the announcements to me, I mean, those are just as important as the music. I would, you know, that may seem weird or crazy or like I'm underrating the music and overrating the announcements, but I swear I'm not. That's as important a part of the texture. And if you really want to sort of hear this as an event, whether you're hearing it at full length or even whether you're just hearing it for 30 or 40 minutes at a time, the announcements are just your tunnel through time, that puts you right in it. If you really want to understand what people's preoccupations were moment to moment, you listen to those.
To get back to the warning that I've received, you may take it with however many grains of salt you wish, that the brown acid that is circulating around us is not specifically too good. It's suggested that you do stay away from that. Of course, it's your own trip, so be my guest, but please be advised that there is a warning on that one, okay?
So there were all kinds of things on those that when we heard them were just, you know, revelatory. I mean, the one I've been thinking about a lot lately is, you know, it's this moment fairly early on the first night where John Morris, who's one of the two primary stage announcers who didn't know that was going to be their job.
Right. Because they didn't have one, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I asked John Morris about this a couple weeks ago, and he said, and nobody else had ever said this to me, he said they had originally, they were going to try some DJs out.
Oh, really?
And he thinks that they actually did have these guys get up at some point. If they did, no tape recording of them survives, but it sounds like they were your typical, hey, everybody, we're here at Woodstock. How's it going? We all going to have a good time. Okay. You know, that kind of thing. And it clearly was so obviously wrong that they just gave them the bum's rush. Right. And it was kind of like, okay, well, I guess we've got to do it.
Right.
So, you know, Morris had an acting background, and he had also helped Bill Graham open the Fillmore East, and Chipmunk was certainly no slouch when it comes to the right. English language and the performance thereof, and had been around all of the same people. So they were all kind of known quantities in that universe, and they both really sort of rose to the occasion in the best possible way. But there's a moment early on the first evening where Morris tries something out that somebody had told him about that they'd seen Tiny Tim do in a small club, which was, let's get our matches and our lighters out and let's all light everything up at one time and see what that looks like. And to me, that's kind of amazing.
Yeah.
Because that's where it comes from, right?
Wow.
There. That is the Ur moment of lighting it up at a concert, that thing that we've all experienced way too many times.
Yeah.
It's passed through the mirror. It's a cliche, but there was a moment, and the moment was right there. Wow. On the first night of Woodstock when John Morris introduced it to that crowd, that definitely was not a cliche. That was a whoa kind of a moment, and we've lived with it ever since. So hearing that was sort of amazing to me, because you realize, like, oh yeah, this is it, this is the thing. You always sort of wonder, oh, where did that thing come from?
Yeah,
I don't know,
right.
Well, here's one of those instances where you can hear it. You can hear it happen for
wow,
the first
that's
time,
so cool.
And it's the root of it all. You know, and in some ways I think Woodstock kind of taught people how to behave at a concert. People always talk about how friendly and benign and peaceful you know, what a lovely experience it was if you were there. And I think to some degree, I think it was because the codes of behavior for events like this had not really been written in stone yet. I think nobody knew what to expect. And if you don't know what to expect, you're probably a little bit more inclined to be on good behavior rather than bad.
Right.
It was other stuff later where people tended to revert to the caveman stuff, but Woodstock was sort of a one of one and unique in that regard. And what I hear and see, like in the film footage and on the tapes, are people just trying to get through this thing by being polite, because it's kind of what Mom said would work, and it does.
Yeah.
It's such an interesting take
it's
on it
wild,
because people
yeah.
think of it now as being, you know, so decadent or whatever. Right. Right? But
well,
you're right. I mean, somehow they managed to make it work despite all the chaos of it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's the, you know, that's that unexpected quality of it. People are always sort of mumbling, like, oh, could it ever happen again? Could it happen again? Will there ever be another Woodstock? And certainly this summer, the answer looks like the
no.
answer is probably no. But
right.
but even before this summer, the answer was still probably no, because it doesn't work that way anymore.
Mm-hmm.
This was a kind of a first in terms of large scale human events with music like this, and it hadn't really been. There were some prototypes, Monterey certainly, and
right.
there were any number of other festivals in 1969 that nobody remembers or cares about now, that weren't as big and that just didn't quite have the gravitas of Woodstock. So those were predecessors, but Woodstock really was the one of one event. And I just think when you've got something like that, people have inevitably tried to reproduce aspects of it. People have tried to co-opt aspects of it. And I just think invariably people just get it wrong. The stuff that persists or the stuff that people have tried to carry along is generally the least interesting, easiest to caricature part of the thing, and doesn't really capture whatever was unique about the moment.
Mm. Like what? What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, it's easy to say, well, we're going to have 35 bands this weekend, and we'll have camping and tents, and there'll be beer and hot dogs and stuff, and you know, and we're going to bring in wavy gravy, and it'll be you know, it's not the same. That's a show, but it isn't necessarily an event of the sort of, you know, of the kind we're talking about here. It's kind of, you know, you could think of a thing like this. It's you know, it, there is something in the, maybe in the Greek sense of catastrophe. I mean, although it's not a catastrophe in the sense that Altamont several months later was a catastrophe. Right. It's sort of a, you know, it was a chaos event. And chaos is a pretty difficult thing to reproduce. And when the thing that kind of brings the event, the magic, you know, the X factor of Woodstock really came from that massive turnout of people, the way people managed to get through and survive the thing in the face of poor supplies, poor planning, rain, mud, you know, the dreaded flat blue acid, you name it. People kind of got through this in a way that probably surprised them and may seem surprising to us now that something like that, you know, if it happened now, it would be, you know, it would be another fire festival and people would be on Instagram every 4 seconds going like, oh, look at this terrible thing. Oh my God. Can you believe this mud? This is the worst, you know, hashtag terrible. It was a different time and the event was sort of allowed to happen in its own time and on its own schedule and in its own space. And so that too is something that you couldn't reproduce that anymore at all. There's no way.
Well, nowadays the whole festival concept has just been commoditized. I mean, you know, it's fine. Go to a festival, have a good time. I've been to them as well, but it's not, they're not singular events the way Woodstock was. I mean, the same bands pretty much tour a festival circuit and you can, you know, go and see all the corporate sponsors of the thing and all that stuff, right? It's a totally different environment today.
Right. You know, the interesting thing is that the guys who planned Woodstock, you know, both Michael Lang and Artie Kornfeld, who were kind of from the, you know, they were sort of around the counterculture, but I'm not sure how counterculture they really were. They were kind of like business hippies.
Yeah.
And their partners, who were definitely not of the counterculture, they were young and they were interested and they were engaged with stuff, but you wouldn't mistake them for countercultural dudes. Roberts and Rosenman, those guys, they knew very early on that there was some potential here for the kind of stuff that we would now, that we every day, that we refer to as branding. There's a fascinating interview that the two of them gave to Howard Smith, who was a popular New York radio personality of the era, maybe a month and a half after Woodstock, maybe 2 months, late September, early October of 69, where they're already talking about maybe trying to do this again and getting Coca-Cola to sponsor them or some other thing. And yeah, we think we can kind of connect advertising agencies and this energetic youth audience and that kind of thing. And so, like, boy, were those guys ahead of the curve. Yeah, I mean, you have to give them credit where due. They saw that years before anybody else saw that, and they were trying to do it years before anybody else figured out how to do it, well, better. But they get points. And, you know, and that's sort of the kind of underbelly of Woodstock too, is that this, you know, they were trying to make money. It wasn't that they were not trying to put on, as somebody termed it at the time, a 3-day freebie. That was not really they weren't altruistic in that sense. This was supposed to be a revenue generating thing, and it quickly turned out to be not that. But they had every intention of selling tickets and doing whatever and milking it for anything it was worth. And they did. Eventually, it took a while, but they did finally break even. And Woodstock Ventures, which owns a lot of the trademarks and the art and the intellectual property pertaining thereto, you know, exists to this day. And they do just fine.
Yes. I will also say this, though. If somebody were to ask you to put together a box set recording of the Fyre Festival, it'd be a lot easier project.
Sure. Yes. Well, I mean, there's less of it.
As in none.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes. You know, there might be some pretty interesting, I'll bet there's some really good iPhone recordings
probably
of people wandering around weeping or complaining or selfieing or YouTubing or whatevering. That would be, you know, that'd be a pretty good compilation right there, but musically speaking, yeah, maybe not so much, not at all, I guess.
I mean, you've been so deep in this. Is there a way that you can step back from it all and sort of take a broader view? Why does Woodstock endure? Why are people still interested in this 50 years later?
It's a really good question. I wonder that myself sometimes. You know, sometimes I think that there's sort of a, you know, there's kind of a parable aspect to it. well, here was this thing and a whole bunch of people assembled, and it could have been a disaster, but it wasn't. And, you know, in much the same way that, you know, if you've ever been on a trip where something went wrong in ways that were vexing at the time, but afterwards in the telling, seemed pretty fun.
Yeah.
Woodstock certainly has some of that quality to it. I think the other really obvious reason is the movie. The movie kind of gave us this, the myth of Woodstock is writ large in Michael Wadley's movie, which is a really good movie. But it created a sort of a mystique around it that continues to endure. That maybe is where a big chunk of the gravitas comes from.
That was smart.
And it's a smartly made movie. It's a movie that I think was meant to sort of, you know, it was meant to articulate something about the audience, both there at the festival and the audience that Wadley was intelligent enough to know were going to consume it in theaters. So, it's an ingeniously built razzle dazzle contraption, but it isn't quite the same as the real Woodstock. It's a version of Woodstock. It's a part of Woodstock. It has big chunks of Woodstock, and it sort of plays around with other bits of it. You know, it's short on chronology and accuracy in that sense. It's long on emotional moments that maybe weren't really that emotional in the moment. You know, Hendrix at the end is a big, that's a big deal. That really is it's a climactic moment in the film, but it was not so much a climactic moment when it was actually played, because most of the audience had left by then. You know, the actual cathartic moments there for the people that were there when there were the most people there probably would have been, you know, I think you'd have to look to Sly Stone, certainly. But you'd also have to look to, and this interests me because they've sort of fallen off the radar in so many ways, and they're not really thought about. Canned Heat, a fascinating band that just for a variety of reasons their reputation has kind of been eclipsed relative to what it was 50 years ago.
Right.
But they were a pulverizing live band, kind of a remarkable live band. They were the loudest band at Woodstock, with apologies to the Who. They were way louder. Loud enough that they blew a bunch of the equipment out.
Wow.
And the crowd, you can hear it on the tapes, the crowd is absolutely going insane. They are eating them up. They are in rapture listening to Canned Heat. And when you hear the Woodstock set, it's really easy to see why. And that was a band that, before I began working with Woodstock, I probably had a kind of a diminished attitude about them. I knew the two hits and, okay, the high-voiced guy singing,
right.
And okay, it's sort of interesting, but like, huh, okay, well, I guess I'm going to have to sit through this, huh? And then, blammo.
Wow.
We heard this thing, and it was just, okay, I think, you know, everything I know is wrong. It was one of those moments. And I've spent a lot of time since getting to know that catalog really, really well. And yeah, I can say that's they're for whatever reason, I'm not sure why they don't endure historically in the way that some of their contemporaries do, but they don't.
Yeah.
And that's a shame. But if you want real catharsis at Woodstock, it doesn't get more cathartic than the 30-minute Woodstock boogie sequence that their proper set ends with. It just flattens the audience.
Wow.
And to a slightly lesser extent, I'd say 10 years after, do that too.
Huh.
Just in terms of things that absolutely work the crowd into a total froth. That's a huge one. And, you know, nobody walks around today going like, oh, 10 years. I mean, they're just not a, right, just not, you know, they're not a band whose critical reputation has endured particularly, although you can hear from the Woodstock set exactly what made them a pretty appealing proposition.
Mm-hmm.
Canned Heat, I think, have a lot more going for them. I would hope that one of these days, a full reappraisal of what they were on about will
That's
take place.
It's very interesting. Yeah. I mean, I know I always knew Canned Heat is the band that John Fahey sort of accidentally introduced to each other and sort of sparked them, you know, coming together. So, but yeah, like you, I know maybe, you know, their greatest hits or something like that in my collection, but
no,
that's,
I mean,
really interesting.
They were the first record collection rock band, you know, decades before Stereolab.
Right.
There was Canned Heat.
Yeah.
Just in terms of people who had really, really studied things and were really thinking hard about what they could borrow and use in a kind of an interesting magpie sort of way that eventually became greater than the sum of the parts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, part of it is that Alan Wilson, who I think was probably the real guiding creative genius of the band, died just before Hendrix did.
Right.
And so his death, I think, was somewhat obscured by that death. And, you know, and to a certain degree, he's not well remembered, but he really should be. You can kind of hear from what he was doing in the year or so before he died. He was really moving into some new spaces, and it would have been just as fascinating to hear where he would have gone as it would have been to hear where Hendrix might have gone.
Right. Interesting.
Over the next 3 to 5 years.
Given that this is a massive project and probably is going to be, you know, very successful, and you know, obviously, if you're on a podcast as famous as ours, there's going to be a tremendous amount of audience.
I mean,
interest.
This is kind of the acme right here.
Really,
this
is kind of at the pinnacle.
My work is done.
Do you feel like, you know, like an actor who's in a hit movie that suddenly all these projects are going to be at your doorstep and people are going to say, "Oh, I want you to do this for us or that," or do you think you're going to start getting all these pitches?
Well, I certainly wouldn't mind.
Right.
I have zero objection to that. Sometimes when you do something like this, it does make it a little bit easier to pick up the phone, and I tend to like to drive those sorts of buses.
Got
so
it.
Anyway, no, I'm certainly, if somebody wants to come to me to say like, "Hey, here's an amazing project, you're the right guy for this," I'm ready to agree with them.
Right.
So sure, that's fine with me. And I haven't really decided. This has been a big one. I have been kind of going 24/7 on this thing for the last year. So
yeah.
I have given myself permission when we're sort of done with the anniversary in a few weeks. We're talking right now, right at the end of July.
Yeah.
And so at this point we have until the 18th, 19th of August. And at that point, I think I've given myself permission to go hibernate like a woodchuck for a couple of months. I look forward to that. I'd like to take some walks. I might like to lie around and read a few crime novels. I'd like to listen to some records that maybe were recorded in the last 6 months
that you missed.
Things like that. Yeah, I feel like I've missed an entire year of pop culture by just being locked away. It's kind of like I feel like some you know chrononaut who's been
defrosted.
Yeah, I've been blasted forward 1 year in time. So I've got to catch up. So yeah, but I'm curious to see what will result from this. I'm optimistic.
Okay, but you don't have anything specific teed up.
I have a couple of things that maybe we'll talk about them in a year or so.
Okay.
if they come to fruition, but I'm hoping that they don't bear any fruit between now and say January, which is when I hope to be
ready to do something again.
But there's a couple of things that I'm trying to move slowly down the conveyor belt, but I've given myself permission not to lock myself into anything until January. That's my Woodstock bonus.
Okay, sounds like you've earned it.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, this has been fascinating.
Thanks for having me. It was really fun.
Yeah.
And stay away from the brown acid.
Right. And the blue.
The blue
and the green. but apparently not the orange, according to Grace Slick.
Gotta get going. Gotta get going. Gotta get going. Gotta get going. Get gone, I can't stay here long now, 'cause I'm tired of the way I've been dogged around. Well, I've got to roam and find me a brand new.
And you know, Jim, I want to say something else too as we wrap up this fascinating interview, and I really want to send our thanks out to Andy and his folks who helped us make this interview happen. You know, we have a P.O. box for Rock in the Suburbs where we encourage you to send us things, and if anyone wants to go to the, you know, the really great lengths to reward us, the address is 800 West Broad Street, Box 6577, Falls Church, Virginia, 22040 is the correct zip code. And I'm not making any certain suggestions, but after listening to these three episodes, if you feel like Jim and Patrick, you know, hold a special place in your heart, just think of us.
There you go.
Yep.
That's all.
That's all I have to say.
makes sense. We got we got 36 hours to spare.
That's right. We got more time than you people want to know about.
Oh, I only wish that were true. But we'll make it true.
Yes, we will.
All right. So again, the set, Woodstock, Back to the Garden, the definitive 50th anniversary archive. If anyone does purchase this for someone else or for yourself, we'd love to hear that.
Oh, yeah. We'd love to find out what
this is like. Mm-hmm. So you get 432 songs on this thing. And
how many are unreleased on this? Like
267.
Holy crap.
So what is that? More than half? More than half.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Have never been released before. So this is really an amazing collection here.
Unprecedented, really. I can't think of anything of this scope or size.
No.
Even the Uncle Dave Macon box set that I have at home doesn't even come close to this. That's only 8 CDs.
All right. Well, I'm sure that's fun too, right?
That's a different thing. Yeah. That's a different durational experience. Yes.
All right. So again, contact us about Woodstock. Let us know what you think. You can call, leave a message,
612-440-1984.
Or you can email rock@suburbspod.com or find us on the Facebook, Twitter, and or Instagram, all of those at Suburbs Pod. We would love to hear from you, especially if your name is Wavy Gravy. That'd be great if you would call in.
Yeah.
Tell us your reflections on this. All right, let's get out of here. We got some more cool stuff next week.
I'm excited to find out what that is.
So am I. We'll see. It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And we'll talk to you guys later.
Time keeps moving on. Friends, they turn away. I'll keep moving on, but I never found out a way. I keep pushing to order, babe. I keep trying to make it right to another lonely day. Whoa. Dawn has come at last. I said there's 25 years, but it's just one night. Oh, yeah. Oh. You're 25 years old and so I know it can't be right. But I'm no better, babe, and I can't help you no more. All the night did win just a girl.
Wheat germ, Holly has your bag. With your medicine, please meet at the information booth as soon as you can, please.